Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The world is closely honed in on Eastern Europe, where Russian troops are threatening neighboring Ukraine. It's called the most significant military mobilization in Europe since World War II. The U.S. estimates Russia has amassed upwards of 190,000 troops on the Ukrainian border, which is nearly double 3 weeks prior. Escalating developments are unfolding by the day, even the hour. And alongside the looming violence at risk of unfolding is the threat of severe sanctions with devastating consequences to the U.S. and global economy. President Biden is expected to announce sanctions this morning and will carry that NPR special coverage directly after Insight. In the meantime, more than 6,000 miles away, Sacramento County is home to a significant Ukrainian and Russian population. The Slavic Assistance Center estimates that number to be around 150,000 refugees in the Sacramento area from the former USSR or Soviet Union. Alex Tovarian is an immigration attorney active in the Russian, Ukrainian, and broader Slavic community in Sacramento County, and he joins us with the conversations and worries that are taking place amid the quickly developing tense uncertainty thousands of miles away. Alex, welcome to Insight. Thank you for taking the time to join us.
Good morning, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
Alex, you're an immigration attorney. Can you just briefly share your background with us and what led you down this path?
Yes, I was born and grew up in this obviously Soviet Union, and then I was an attorney in Russia. And my path to the U.S. started when I was in college, and I was lucky enough to be a participant in an exchange program. And I studied in the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, for a year, and that's how I got introduced to the United States and the law school. In the United States, and basically then I left and went back home, but then I decided that I wanted to come back here and then practice law here, and that's what I did.
How do you explain what's unfolding in Ukraine to someone who may be aware of the headlines that are taking place but doesn't understand why this is happening?
Yeah, well, of course, prevailing part of the experts who closely observe the situation agree on the same thing, that unfortunately Vladimir Putin is invading or tries to invade another part of Ukraine, and he is actually looking for some sort of excuses to do so, because as we know, he did this with the unlawful annexation of Crimea
in 2014. After which
the war erupted in the eastern part of Ukraine. And what Vladimir Putin is doing right now is looking for some sort of excuse or a loophole, if you will, to continue moving forward and getting more territories. And all experts basically say the same thing, that Vladimir Putin does not have a goal of completely restoring the Soviet Union per se, but he does have a goal of restoring his own Russia, so that he will never be forgotten for what he did, because his idea, which is driven by, you know, many experts say, driven by his sick ego, is that he wants to basically create a larger part of Russia, and hopefully he's going to be in the books one day.
Given that this is a volatile time, and I want to get to what happened in Crimea in 2014, because essentially what I'm hearing from you is this is a continuation of that conflict several years ago. But what were relations like between neighboring Ukrainians and Russians prior to 2014?
Vicky, it was absolutely peaceful, and it was basically, people were saying that Ukraine and Russia it's the same ethnicity, it's the same population, it's the same country, even though the countries officially were different, but they were two neighboring countries, and people were always close, and unfortunately for some people, there's so many families even today who have relatives, you can be residing in Russia and have relatives in Ukraine or vice versa. So it was very peaceful and friendly. Unfortunately, that's no longer the case.
This crisis is affecting a lot of your clients. What can you share with us?
Well, from what I hear, and I do see a lot of families who come from Russia or come from Ukraine. And like I said, this is exactly what I hear and what I see people share with me, that after Crimea, a lot of families were broken because people who lived in Crimea or people who lived in Ukraine, after what Vladimir Putin did, a lot of people lost their relatives, that they no longer speak with each other because, you know, everybody has got his or her story, right? And it's very difficult for them to stay in touch and remain a family.
Well, given that what is currently unfolding, and given that Sacramento has a huge Ukrainian community, also with Russian relatives, are these relationships continuing to be frayed?
Yes, yes. And as you noted, and as the whole world is watching right now, unfortunately, the situation in Ukraine is getting worse and worse. And what we see right now is, you know, like I said, Vladimir Putin, the way we see it, is looking for a loophole, even though the talks in the Russian media are so holy that, you know, we're sending peacemakers to the Ukrainian territory. But the reality is that this is just an excuse or some sort of like fabricated explanation that, you know, Russian troops are entering, they're going to stay. And what's going to happen, nobody knows, because there are still territories which may be invaded, and we will not be surprised. So all these facts, unfortunately, drive us to sad conclusions that, of course, families continue being on bad terms.
Hmm. What is the level of concern that you're gauging in our community here in Sacramento County?
The level of concern is that, you know, we all stay in all types of social medias, and I have a lot of friends and I have a lot of followers, and unfortunately, at this point, the only thing that we see is when it comes to from Ukrainian people, and you'll be surprised, but I see so many messages, even from people who actually came from Russia. It's a huge support of the Ukraine. It's a huge support of Ukrainian people. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of different logos on Facebook, which say, you know, let's say no to war. You know, we are against the war. So that type of message is most common right now.
I understand that you view this as an invasion, and also Western countries as well, but you also understand there are other points of view. There are even individuals that are sympathetic to Vladimir Putin. I mean, what is their rationale that you're hearing? Because they're part of this community as well.
Of course. Yeah, people who support Vladimir Putin and his actions, their explanation is very simple. They say that that unfortunately Russia has to do what Russia is doing for only one reason, because Russia did not listen to, actually Russia failed to comply with the agreement which was entered into back in 1990 with Mikhail Gorbachev, when the West provided some sort of guarantees that the NATO and the US will not be moving closer to Russia, if you will. So that's the biggest argument that you will see watching federal channels, you know, Russian federal channels. So their argument is that we have to protect our turf. We have to invade additional territories for only one reason, so that we will be able to push our enemies away from us, so that the Russia will be safe. So that's basically the message. That's what people are seeing watching mass media in Russia.
Hmm. Hearing that, I'm remembering when we had a conversation briefly before this interview that when you were talking with one client in particular, that really kind of exemplifies the disagreements that are taking place within families. And this individual, he has a trial coming up on March 9th in one of your clients. Can you share that story? Because I think it really encompasses the pain and the fraying that is currently happening right now.
It really does. It really does. It's actually one of the best examples. And in a sense, I'm very happy that I have a trial coming up right now, because the situation in Ukraine will certainly help us to demonstrate the country conditions. So the what we're dealing with right now with this family, it's pretty tragic. They were born and there grew up in Lugansk, which is part of the eastern part of Ukraine. And when the war erupted, he, among other people, was a participant in a peaceful rallies, which were basically against the war. And unfortunately, they were treated as traitors. They were treated as enemies. They were treated as spies, if you will. And he experienced such persecution from the government that he actually realized that he had to flee. And he had relatives living in Russia, and he moved to Russia. And what happened next was never predicted by him. But what happened next was when he came to Russia, immediately, shortly thereafter, the Russian FSB, security services, approached them, and not only approached them, but they actually also participated in persecution of him, because now, ironically enough, now the other country was actually saying exactly the same thing to him, that why are you guys here? You are our enemies. You are spies. And basically, at the end of the day, they were pushed out from the country with a toddler on their hands, and they had nothing else to do but to move back to Ukraine. But they tried to hide in a different part of Ukraine, such as, for example, Kyiv or Odessa, which has nothing to do with the eastern part. But believe it or not, exactly the same thing happened with them. When they entered Ukraine, they were immediately apprehended by the CBP, basically, at the border. And then they were interrogated by the special security services of Ukraine. And exactly the same thing happened when they were told and heavily interrogated, because they resided in Russia for some time. Now the Ukrainian part and Ukrainian authorities became seriously concerned that, who are you people? Why are you here? You resided in Russia. You present danger. We don't know who you are. We suspect that you are spies. And believe it or not, they were harshly persecuted. They were physically attacked. He had several fractures in his leg, and his wife was also physically attacked when they tried to hide in another city. They were never left alone, and that is when they decided that they had to flee, and they truly had no place to hide, and they went to Mexico and they requested political asylum at the border. So that is going to be our case, and it's really tragic.
It is tragic, and they weren't welcomed in either country. Before I let you go, Alex, that brings me to, with people who have family in Ukraine or Russia, what are they hearing from loved ones as they're watching everything unfold here in Sacramento?
You mean from the loved ones here?
The loved ones that live in Ukraine, in eastern Ukraine, or that live in Russia. What are they hearing from people that call those places home, and they're watching this very tenuous event unfold by the hour? What are they hearing, and what are their concerns?
Vicky, they hear very, very different messages, just like I mentioned at the beginning of this program. And the messages, if you are someone from Russia, you hear that basically you must praise Vladimir Putin, because what he's doing, nobody has ever done, and he's really saving Russia. And if you talk to someone in Ukraine, they basically hear that we're a small country, we do not have any aggression towards Russia. Even though we did lose some territories, we do not have any plans to attack Russia. And people, and I actually watched some experts on TV from Ukraine who were voicing their concerns, and they were trying to say that if you guys are watching us, you have to remember one thing: we are Ukraine, we are a country, and even though we were invaded, we don't have any plans to attack. So, and that message is being sort of sent to the Russian side, to the Russian population. And they basically say that, listen, if you hear that we engage in some sort of a military action against Russia, that would be false, because we do not plan to do so. And I believe that.
Alex, thank you so much for joining us and helping us unpack what's unfolding.
Thank you, Vicky, for having me.
Alex Tovarian is an immigration attorney active in the Russian, Ukrainian, and broader Slavic community in Sacramento County. And as I mentioned, there is a programming note to pass along. President Biden will be delivering remarks on the Russia-Ukraine situation at 10 a.m. NPR will be carrying those remarks live. And again, that is at 10 a.m. immediately following Insight. Up next, the Winter Olympic Games is now a piece of history. With the torch flames still smoldering, we'll talk about some of the bigger messages and hear stories from local Olympians. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Shaun White, Michaela Schifrin, Nathan Chen, Aaron Jackson, Chloe Kim, Eileen Gu, and Kamila Valieva. If you spent any time over the last 2 weeks watching the 2022 Winter Olympic Games, some or all of those names are likely to be familiar to you by now. The storylines of the Winter Olympics just now starting to take focus after a magical closing ceremony on Sunday from Beijing, where the Olympic torch was extinguished and passed on to Italy, which will host the 2026 Winter Games. And many of our local athletes are now coming back with memories from Beijing, from the protocols surrounding the pandemic to the challenges and triumphs of competing against the best athletes from around the world. We are fortunate here in Northern California to have so many connections to the Olympic Games, and no one is more plugged in than KCRA anchor and Olympics reporter Deirdre Fitzpatrick. Deirdre has traveled to 10 consecutive Olympics, both summer and winter, over two decades until COVID threw a wrench in things. But her daily, seemingly 24/7 coverage has continued from afar. Deirdre joins us once again to share her reporting and insight with us. Welcome back, Deirdre.
Hi, how are you?
I was thinking about our conversation. I was just like, where do we begin, Deirdre? There is just so many
places.
You have covered so many Olympic Games, and you couldn't travel to Beijing for these games due to the pandemic. But from afar, what is your overall big picture, your big impression of the 2022 Winter Games?
I think a lot of people are glad it's done, honestly. You know, I mean, I really do. I think people were uncomfortable going into it. If you remember back to when Beijing was awarded the Olympics, it was kind of because everybody else didn't want it. You know, it came down to Beijing and Kazakhstan, and the IOC looked at it and said, well, we know Beijing will pull it off. And that's really how it ended up in China again after the 2008 Summer Olympics. You know, the other countries just had pulled out. Mm-hmm. And so it was always kind of a reluctant, for a lot of people, it was kind of a reluctant giving host city for a lot of people. And then you add in a pandemic, right, and all kinds of issues that have happened in the last couple of years. And I think there was a lot of like, okay, here we go. And I think people are just glad in a lot of ways that it's over. And you still have the Paralympics, don't forget, starting on March 4th.
Next week.
But I think overall people are like, are glad that it's done, that for the most part, people stayed healthy. For the most part, they stayed safe. But it definitely, there's a weird vibe coming out of it, without a doubt.
Yeah, this is a second Olympic within, what, 6 months? But
amid, 6 months?
Yeah, amid a pandemic, you know, really, yeah, largely not having audiences. When you were talking with athletes in our area that were in Beijing, did it stain their Olympic experience given all the COVID protocols and just how unprecedented the situation was?
You know, it's interesting. I talked to an athlete, Winter Vanecki, who is an aerial skier, and I asked her about that. I said, do you feel a little bit ripped off? Because you never know if you get to go to a second one where you might get the more true Olympic experience. And she said something that really stuck with me, which was, it's all I know. So of course it's exciting. So with a really young, fresh impression of all of it, it's like, okay, yeah, sure. It was all really exciting to be there despite everything else, because it's all she knew. If you talk to a four-time Olympian like Alana Myers Taylor, she's had the experience of being in amazing places where there weren't these bigger concerns, whether it was human rights, a pandemic, freezing cold, not being able to have your family, you name it. So, you know, she has a little bit more to compare it to. So it's weird in some ways, the newbies might have actually had a little bit of an advantage because they didn't know what they were missing.
Yeah. Did they comment, or did they have any, how did it feel to not even have very few spectators and family? I remember watching the opening games and NBC had this coverage of families, you know, in the United States, you know, watching them walk in, and just kind of the bittersweet and the heartache of not being able to be there in person.
I think it depends on what kind of a sport you do. If you're a skater, you thrive on that audience because you can hear them. Because as much as you might try to blank them out, you really can't, because you see thousands of people, you certainly hear them. When you fall, there's that, oh, when you do something amazing, there's that, oh, wow. You know, like you hear that reaction. But if you're a skier, say you're, you know, somebody like Travis Ganong, he described it to me as, he's at the top of a mountain. His job is to get everybody else out of his head. Mm-hmm. If you're at the top of a half pipe, your job is to block out that noise. You saw Eileen Gu go through that strange visualization. I shouldn't say strange. It clearly worked. That visualization where she went through her entire performance before she even dropped into the half pipe. You know, like I think for people like that, that crowd isn't as crucial as it is for other types of performances. So it probably depended on the person. You know, selfishly, for some of the athletes who are bigger names, it meant that they had fewer distractions. They didn't have to worry about, did my mom get her tickets? It, you know, did my dad get the right seat? There's a little bit of that. And that's how they've been competing for the last year. So for skiers who've been overseas, primarily in Europe, some venues didn't have anybody. They were just competing for each other. So they actually were a little bit more used to it than we were as an audience.
Yeah. When it comes to local athletes in Northern California, what were the breakout performances? Is anyone taking home a medal?
Well, yes, but not for us. I think Eileen Gu is the name that nobody knew. And boy, they sure know it now, right? You know, I mean, I think she was somebody that I think for people in Northern California, when they would hear that she grew up in San Francisco, going to Stanford, did some training, though not a lot, in Tahoe. There was a little bit of like, well, wait a minute, why isn't she with us? She's clearly an amazing athlete who decided to compete for her mother's home country. So I think that name certainly is certainly on the radar for a lot of people. I think, you know, locally, our two top skiers, Bryce Bennett and Travis Ganong, who had top 20 finishes, didn't make a podium, but in their sport, going top 20, top 15 is a big, big deal. If you can, you know, hang there with the Europeans, and they both had great years. Just, you know, away from the Olympics. So there were some really amazing things to be proud of. David Wise at Reno, who we call, you know, claim for Tahoe because that's where he trains, winning silver again, and just such a wonderful athlete and role model for so many people. I would say those are some of our top ones locally that we certainly enjoyed following.
The Olympics were held. Well, we just had this conversation a few minutes ago. Russian-Ukrainian tensions continued to evolve. The United States also diplomatically boycotted the Games by not sending an official delegation from the Biden administration. But what was kind of surprising to some people, there were little to no public protests of even the human rights issues in China or the other issues around the world. What struck you about all of that?
You know, I think that bubble is really tight. And I can tell you, having gone as a journalist to certain games, and I'm thinking of the 2014 games
in Sochi,
in Russia, or even, in Sochi, or even the 2008 games in Beijing when we were there for the summer, you know, like we, even as journalists, were kind of told, hey, let's be a good citizen while you're there. You know, it's not a time for you to be raising a lot of extra attention or looking to investigate those types of things. I mean, we went in to cover the Olympics, and that was kind of it as Olympic journalists. And I think athletes also were told this is a precarious type of Olympics right now. You know, go in, do the testing, please don't protest, just do what we've been asked to do so that we can get in, compete, and get out. And you saw how quickly our athletes especially were out. Within 48 hours of competing, they were out of that country and they're back over here. And very few journalists were sent over. I mean, very, very few. I think there were a total of 600 for NBC, which is not very much. Most of the people who worked the Olympics were in Connecticut, working out of trucks and hotels. So, you know, I think those bubbles were very tight. Certainly the athletes have described that, where every move they made was recorded to reduce the risk of any kind of spread of COVID. And I guess I'm not really surprised that you didn't hear a lot of the extra stuff.
What was it like being in Sochi during that time of Crimea?
It was really unnerving. I'll be honest with you. We went into it. We go into those different kinds of Olympics, and you get a lot of training behind the scenes for things that you might encounter while you're there. And we went through a lot of terrorism training before we even got there. I mean, I remember having to watch videos about like how to tie a tourniquet just in case you ended up in a situation where you needed it. And the amount of kind of low-grade stress that you lived with every single day after a while became kind of unnerving. And so when we were in Russia, everywhere we went, I'm not exaggerating, every 5 to 10 feet, there was a Russian military official standing there with weaponry. And that was everywhere you went. We were constantly under supervision, surveillance, heavy display of weaponry. Outside of the Olympic Village, you would see these mass camps of Russian military members who never really left. So, you know, it was kind of a military staging, which of course you might remember right before the end of the Olympics, there were the issues with Crimea. So it's some of it is kind of oddly familiar to what we're even seeing right now. And it's not the first time that Russia has used an Olympics for some type of invasion. In fact, I think it's the third time. There was one in 2008, which was the invasion in Georgia. Then you had Ukraine, Crimea, back in 2014, and now you're seeing this situation with Ukraine. So, you know, the Olympics the optics of the Olympics are a great distraction, but they also can be there to make a point because you got a lot of nations paying attention.
Yeah, there may be an Olympic bubble, but it's not a bubble from what's taking place.
No.
From current events all over the world.
Definitely not.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. KCRA anchor and Olympics reporter Deirdre Fitzpatrick is joining us to talk about the Winter Olympics. Okay, let's get to the triumphs and the heartbreaking moments and your thoughts on some of these major headlines that emerged from the Games. Erin Jackson became the first African-American woman to win gold in speed skating, and we kicked off the Winter Olympic Games talking about the lack of diversity in the Winter Olympics, especially when compared to the Summer Games. What stands out to you about this?
Well, I think Erin Jackson is a wonderful story. You know, Erin Jackson, I think Alana Myers Taylor, a four-time Olympian who's now the most decorated Black athlete in the Winter Olympics with 5 career medals. I mean, the important thing about athletes like them is that they show a lot of kids all over the country, if you can see it, you can be it. And so they've had this great opportunity to see that people who grew up in areas where there isn't snow can go out and do these incredible Winter Olympic sports. So it shows the importance of the USOPC going out and actively recruiting just talented athletes in places where you might not associate those sports. And one of the ways they've done that over the last, you know, 10, 15 years is they run these combines. So like they would at football camp, where they find athletes, mainly track and field athletes, because they're very utilitarian for lots of different sports. And they test them to see, like, what are you good at? Are you a fast sprinter? Are you powerful? Are you, you know, fill in the blank? And that's where you find a bobsledder. Because how many of us live near a bobsled track? Very few.
Right.
You got Lake Placid, you got Park City. But somehow we find bobsledders out of Georgia, like Alana Myers Taylor. And it's because you go out and you actively look for people who might be good at something and you teach them how to do it. So I think that the beauty of those women being such incredible, not only athletes, but role models, is that they really show a new generation of kids that there are these great possibilities. And are you going to make a lot of money as a bobsledder? No. Are you going to find an amazing platform and maybe an interesting life? Yeah, possibly. Mm-hmm. And that's what they both have done.
And talking about role models, you mean, you, I can't help but think of Michaela Schifrin. You know, she didn't finish in three of her five individual events. I think she said, quote, "I don't know if anybody's failed that hard with so many opportunities, maybe in the history of the Olympics, but it's really like failing with grace and honesty and just 26 years old, but the emotional maturity to raise an awareness about also not being perfect, and especially following Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka when raising, you know, the pressures and the mental health that comes along with being an athlete."
Yeah, they've opened a dialogue that is really powerful, and that a lot of athletes, not just female, but male, are also joining and acknowledging how difficult some of these perches that they find themselves on, how precarious they really are. She's certainly one that people kind of never saw coming. I don't think anybody thought what happened with her was going to happen. But I don't think I'll ever forget seeing that shot of her sitting there in the snow for 20 long minutes, knowing, I mean, she knew cameras are watching. I mean, how powerful for people, so many of us going through difficult times 2 years into this pandemic. Her situation, I think, you know, nobody had more pressure than Michaela Schifrin. I always say, whoever's in all those NBC commercials, man, you better perform. Because you're the target. And for being the target, you're well rewarded. I mean, Michaela Schifrin is probably, next to Shaun White, one of the best paid Winter Olympians ever.
Yeah.
So, you know, there is the cost for that much pressure. You can say, oh, there's too much pressure. There's also a lot of compensation for that pressure too. And until this point, she's produced. Something was just different this time. Something was off.
I'm going to get to Shaun White in a second, but I think one of the biggest controversies in this Olympics is 15-year-old Russian figure skater Kamila Valieva, and just really that bizarre finish and upsetting scene at the women's individual free skate, and the coaches coming under fire with how they handled it following that. And then I go back to the Summer Olympics, Sha'Carri Richardson saw a double standard in being able to compete. There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, there is. You know, I mean, the difference is, you know, you had Sha'Carri being judged by the USOPC, where we have pretty strict rules about certain things. And then you have Valieva, that was falling under IOC and WADA. I find her situation tremendously, you know, disappointing, but alarming because of her age. You know, I kept coming back to, she's 15 years old. Well, a lot of them are 15 years old. It's one of those things that you forget about, is how young many of these athletes are. And there are plenty of skiers, skaters who are teenagers who go off with national teams, regardless of what country they're from. And, you know, as a parent, you kind of hand them over, and they're being supervised by coaches or by other people who might belong to chaperone. But, you know, a lot of them, they're very, very young, and they grew up very isolated from a lot of the realities that we all do with traditional school and friends and bigger networks. They grew up in a real tight little bubble. And that situation, watching that whole thing play out that night, and even watching, you know, the other two Russian skaters and the interaction with their coach, the fact that the IOC president, Tomas Bach, came out the next day and actually condemned it and said how wrong it was so shocking. Mm-hmm. He doesn't say anything. He doesn't ever play cards. Everything's unicorns. You know, everything is always about the bigger mission of the Olympics. And for him to come out and talk about how unsettling and troubling it was, told you how bad it really is.
Yeah.
And that was quite a moment. You know, and I thought it was interesting to have somebody like a Tara Lipinski, who won gold at 15, as one of the commentators. And the fact that she basically said nothing, said everything.
Yeah. We're going to end on a positive note. We have about 30 seconds, ending on Shaun White. He didn't receive a medal, but it was still a very powerful and emotional moment. I mean, retiring as an Olympian and a 3-time gold medal winner.
In your 30s. Yeah, I know. You know, what was so powerful to me was, you know, I've been covering him since he was a teenager, since he was 16 years old. And I remember interviewing him after he'd won gold in the Torino Olympics. It was like 1 a.m, freezing cold outside. And I remember his mother standing about 6 feet away, and she was always there when he was young. Mm-hmm. Big difference there. She was always there. And it was interesting to watch him kind of go out as almost like the elder statesman of his sport. And I found it really touching that all these young snowboarders from around the world lined up to give him a hug and to say thank you.
Yep.
And I thought that's leaving right.
Deirdre, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Vicky.
Hopefully next time we'll get you live in Paris in 2024.
Well, we got a couple of years.
Yeah.
Let's hope the world is righted by that point.
Deirdre Fitzpatrick is an anchor and Olympics extraordinaire at KCRA Channel 3. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Inside on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Do you remember when you were first fascinated by dinosaurs? Well, I do. And as you'll hear from my conversation with Dino Don Lessem, a self-described world authority on dinosaurs, a 30-year career, which includes being a science advisor to the original Jurassic Park and theme parks, as well as excavating the largest dinosaurs in the world, dozens of books and exhibitions seen by more than 10 million people in 10 countries, including the Sacramento Zoo. Right now, you can walk amongst dinosaurs at the Dinosaur Safari, put on by Dino Don Incorporated, where anatomically correct dinosaur robots are on display for all to enjoy. Dino Don is in Sacramento now, and with him, he brings dinosaur bones, an egg, and even a surprise that I'll let him tell you about. Dino Don will be at the zoo today and tomorrow, showing off his cool prehistoric fossils and inspiring people of all ages with his passion for dinosaurs. I spoke with Dino Don just before he made the trip to Sacramento.
Okay, I gotta tell you, I know where my interest in dinosaurs came from. I mean, my childhood kind of centered around Jurassic Park. I was in fifth grade and I wore that VHS out. But I have to ask you, where did your interest in dinosaurs come from?
Well, first of all, you know, I worked on that movie.
Yes. But
my first introduction to dinosaurs, to answer your question, I was five. I lived in New York and my aunt would take me to the Natural History Museum in New York. And they have a great collection of dinosaurs there. And those days they used to pose T-Rex like up like this, like flick of the horse who's scared. And it's all wrong, but it was very dramatic. And I used to give tours. Nobody asked me to, but I thought it was a nice idea for a five-year-old to take people through the museum. So there's a lot of nerdy kids like me who were just obsessed.
You know, I'm curious, when I was doing a little bit of research on your background, you have a bachelor's in art history and a master's in animal behavior, correct?
Yeah, I failed at a number of different things. First of all, I had a really bad idea to be an art history major since I'm colorblind. That was not a lot of foresight there. So I could only do black and white paintings. Well, I got very interested in gorillas after I graduated school, you know, like Diane Fossey, the woman from Gorillas in the Mist. And so I thought I would go to grad school for that. And then I realized, oh, you have to work really hard. Well, that's no good. So I became a reporter because the scientists were doing these wonderful things and they don't know how to speak English, really. They can't communicate to the public very well. So really, I've been a middleman ever since, just sort of like a low-budget David Attenborough, telling people what's going on in the science.
Well, that all makes sense from this point of view, looking at all that you've accomplished over the last three decades. But when you were pursuing these different fields and failing at a lot of things, as you said, did you have an idea of where it would lead?
None. I was a reporter at the Boston Globe writing mainly stories about nature, but not dead things. And the editor of the magazine section said, this is 1988, why don't you go and there are these two crazy dinosaur scientists who are very famous. Why don't you go out in the field with them? So I went and I basically never came back.
And the rest is history.
The rest is prehistory, yes.
Prehistory. Did you imagine that this career and really this fascination and passion would intersect with, as you were part of, one of the highest grossing movies of all time and also subsequent theme parks that you were a part of?
Yeah, no, it's all serendipity, really, you know. I think the thing to do in life is just pursue every opportunity that presents itself, and one or more will happen. I mean, I had some spectacular things that haven't happened, but nobody knows about it. So I interviewed Crichton, the author of Jurassic Park, for the newspaper. And I had started a charity to raise money for research because these guys have no money at all. Like to dig up a giant dinosaur, $6,000, and they can't find the money to do it. So I was raising money and I didn't know what I was doing. And he said, you don't know what you're doing. So he gave me a little money and he told Spielberg to do something for my charity. And so they did very minor things. But then I said, you know, everything in this movie's wrong. So you don't listen to me. Can I just have all the sets and props? I'm going to make an exhibit, something I'd never done. And all the money will go to dinosaur research. So we made an exhibit, Dinosaur Fact and Fiction in Jurassic Park. And of course, it was very successful. And we raised like $3 million for research. And I thought, oh, I like doing exhibits. I'll do this instead of writing. There you go.
That's incredible. And there's going to be an exhibit here at the Sacramento Zoo. You're going to be traveling here and you'll be here in person Tuesday and Wednesday. Explain to us what is so special and what is so challenging about making robots anatomically correct.
Oh, thanks for asking, Vicky. Well, first of all, I avoided robots like the plague for most of my life because they were kind of half size and clunky and they move like they have some kind of nerve disease. So I thought, well, these kind of suck. And I went to China where they're all made, to the same town where they're all made, because the greatest dinosaur quarry in the world is there. So I went to see fossils and I just thought, oh, I'll check in the factory. And I saw they're all made by hand. There is no bad mold that they're working from. So if you gave them the right information, that's a long-winded way around to your question, which is I brought a scientist and a paleo artist there and said to the artists, the little old ladies with the X-Acto knives and the foam couch cushions, do it this way. And it came out the exact size. A lot of the things we know now about how dinosaurs look, we can incorporate into these animals. So if you go to the Sacramento Zoo, which everybody should every day if they have children, otherwise it's being terrible parents, you'll see that just the scale of these animals. There was a very popular exhibit at the zoo a few years ago, which I didn't see, about baby dinosaurs. So this is a whole different scale of animals than you saw before.
You have a 30-year history of creating dinosaur exhibitions. What is different from the first exhibits that you did three decades ago?
Well, you know, you ask questions nobody ever asked. I like you.
Oh, good. I like you too.
Well, I'll see you in Sacramento, maybe. The difference is, well, first of all, you learn, you know, it's like anything else, you learn as you go. I'm sure you weren't as good an interviewer when you start, but I learned how important it is to have human contact. People most remember in an exhibit the person that they met, who showed them around a little bit. And then that people are not readers. I mean, it's a little scary, but only 9% of people read signs when they go through an exhibit. So you got to find another way. And then if you want people to remember something, you have to tell it to them three times in different ways. But most important thing I realized is you don't have to really tell them things. It's the experience. And when a kid comes and he sees a 50-foot dinosaur and his mouth goes wide open and his eyeballs open like that, that means he's going to go home and read everything he can find about dinosaurs and watch everything he can find. So the real job, I think, that is a great job, is to get kids more enamored, to feed their addiction and make them really want to learn more. I'm not the place, the exhibit's not the place they're going to learn everything. It's what it makes you do afterwards.
Right. The more you feel, the more you remember. And it's the spark. And when they leave with that spark, what do you hope to inspire in those who leave with that spark and actually see your exhibits?
I want them all to buy my book, and then I get like 25 cents for each person who does it.
Does that go to research too?
No, I'm kind of hoping that they get some understanding. We usually have a dig pit with the exhibit, so you actually get to experience what it's like to make the connection between past and present. I mean, there's so much to learn from this, between the animals that are alive today and how they behave and how the dinosaurs behave. There's a lot of parallels. And to figure out this whole science process of how you look at things and you put them back together again and you end up with this. It's very cool.
It is. And you have dug up and put together the biggest dinosaurs in the world, right? A herbivore and a meat-eating one. So your work also goes beyond exhibits. I mean, and as you mentioned, I mean, you partner and you funded millions of dollars towards paleontology excavations and research around the world. I would imagine it doesn't get boring for you. It's still very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, it's the curse of the ADD personality. I have to change what I do every once in a while, but I love it. It's all within dinosaurs, but there's all kinds of different things. With one exception, I'm in love with Genghis Khan, so I make exhibits about Genghis Khan too. But, you know, I go to the weirdest places in the world, and I love it because you don't find dinosaurs in downtown Sacramento. You got to go to the desert and, you know, places like Mongolia and Argentina. So it feeds a lot of interest besides just the dinosaurs themselves. But the idea, and I'm not the first guy to say this, that you are looking at this thing that you excavated. You're the first person who's ever seen this animal. It's just it's a staggering thought. And, you know, makes you feel like, wow, I contributed something this way. And then I got a dinosaur named after me, which you can see.
That was going to be my next question. Okay. Which dinosaur was that?
Well, it's named after my last name, Lesomosaurus. And it's pretty much one of the stupider dinosaurs. It has a really large stomach. So I don't know what the inspiration exactly was. Actually, I do know. The guy who named it after me, you can't do it after yourself. That's not kosher. But usually you have to be dead. And the scientist who named it after me thought, oh, this guy has all these exhibits. He must be really rich. He didn't realize I was giving it all away. So he thought, I'll name the dinosaur after him and he'll write me a big check. So now he's really disappointed, but it's too late. That's a kind of cool thing. So
it's a very cool thing. And yeah. With that dinosaur out of the mix, do you have a favorite dinosaur? Or are they all kind of like your children? You love them all the same?
No, I neglect some of my children. And, yes, there's a dinosaur. I think some kids will know, called Troodon. It's like Velociraptor, only slighter in build. The little guy is the size of a second grader, but it was the smartest dinosaur that ever lived. About as smart as a living ostrich. That doesn't sound that smart to you, but compared to the rest of the animal kingdom and compared to everything that was alive then, including our ancestors, little mousy mammals, this was by far the smartest thing out there. It's a brain the size of an avocado pit on a teeny animal. So it's kind of fun to think about, oh, what could this animal do? Yeah. And how aware was it in this world? And I just love upending the ideas, like dinosaurs are big and slow and stupid. Well, here's the guy who's little and smart and clever, you know. So I love him. My house is named Troodon Manor, and then it's full of dinosaurs. So I have some of the things I'm bringing out to Sacramento to the zoo. Like, this is a dinosaur egg, 65
wow.
million.
It's like the size of your head.
It is. I don't have that big a head. This is not the biggest dinosaur egg, though. Still, compared to a dinosaur, they're not big. The biggest one is about 2 footballs, and that belonged to a big meat eater. And I have dinosaur ribs, all kinds of things that I want to show kids and have it be at the zoo. So make that connection between the fossil and the live thing. In fact, if I was to be with you, I would show you this so you could hold it. It's dinosaur poop.
Oh, and it's fossilized.
It's fossilizes like other stuff. And when you're 5 years old, this is really important.
Yeah, that's probably one of the cooler things, I would imagine.
Well, what I do when I give talks is I take the kid who's the naughtiest and I bring him up at the end. And I tell him, which is true, fossils have lots of holes. That's one way you distinguish them from bones. So prospectors, when they're out west and they couldn't tell whether this chunk was a bone or a fossil, they would lick it because you're in the dry weather, it sticks your tongue like a potato chip to all the holes. So then I have this kid licking poop before I tell him. And that's the sadistic end of what I do.
Well, on that note, I guess my last question is this, obviously, I mean, you have dinosaurs surrounding your home and it's obviously a passion and you're touching so many lives. What do you do on your free time? Do you have hobbies outside of paleontology?
Yeah,
And Genghis Khan.
And Genghis Khan. Yeah, I do. I play a lot of tennis, but my knees are falling apart with old age. But I love doing that. And then I have all these other projects that I know will never finish. Right now, I'm really interested in Spiritualism by Harry Houdini. He was a very interesting, conflicted guy who debunked a whole lot of people who, in his time, who were looking for ghosts, but he still believed in them and wanted them to live. So I'm trying to write a play about this, which will never happen, but what the heck.
It very well could happen. You've accomplished a lot in your life.
Yeah, well, I hope so. Be nice.
Thank you so much, Don.
My pleasure, Vicky. Thank you for talking to me.
And that is Dino Don Lessem, who will be at the Sacramento Zoo today and tomorrow. The Dinosaur Safari exhibit will be at the Sacramento Zoo until April 17th. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Arm Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow. But there is a programming note to pass along. President Biden will be delivering remarks on the Russia-Ukraine situation at 10 a.m. That's going to happen in about 2 minutes, and NPR will be carrying those remarks live immediately following Insight.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.